Okay, I believe we're on the air. My name is Chuck Steiger, and I'm talking today with Mr. Leonard Lyles, who is the personnel director?
No, my job is director of Equal Opportunity Affairs, and of course that comes under the personnel department.
In Brown Williams?
Brown Williams and Tobacco Corporation, mm-hmm.
And today's date is May 20th, 1977, and this interview is one of a series concerning black history in Louisville, Kentucky. And I wonder if we could just begin with getting some general biographical background, where you were born and raised, your parents, your education, and your profession, and how you got into it through.
Well, you know, it's amazing trying to recall all that, actually, but I understand that I was born in Nashville, Tennessee. Of course, my mother and my family moved here when I was 3 years old. And we basically was raised in the inner city, 16th and Walnut, and of course we moved several times. We lived with my grandparents out around Algonquin Parkway sometimes after that. And of course I went to elementary school, and of course went to Central High School. And
at
Central
High
School,
by the way?
Oh, I was born in January 26, 1936. And Central High School, I played athletics there, of course. And leaving Central High School, I went on to the University of Louisville and participated in athletics, and then from there to professional football. That's kind of real quick, the way things kind of developed. But in the beginning, I guess, we lived, as I said, in the inner city, and we didn't live in the best neighborhood. Of course, the inner city neighborhood, I think you're familiar with most inner cities, they're pretty much the same. A lot of people, in many cases, the housing conditions are poor. But I was fortunate enough to have a fairly good structured family. My mother did quite a bit to try and help me out. Her name is Alice Lyles, and she lives on Jefferson Street right now. And my father was a laborer. His name is Herod Lyles. And fortunately, unfortunately, we didn't have all of the things I think that is needed today, particularly today. Maybe then it wasn't so bad to develop and build the kinds of things that most kids need. It was just me and my sister. I have a sister named Doris Lyles, who now she resides in Atlanta, Georgia. So it was not easy growing up. It was quite difficult, and I started work at an early age, around 12 years old. I was shining shoes, working at the car wash, spent quite a bit of time doing construction-type work. And I was fortunate enough to have enough interest to stay in school during the whole time. And, of course, I'm sure if it were not for athletics, I probably would have fell by the wayside years ago. So that basically is the beginning in terms of Leonard Lyles coming to Louisville, Kentucky, and moving on from there to my educational background.
I'm curious, you mentioned your dad was a laborer and you did some construction work. In his experience, if you remember, and with yours, were there any problems for blacks getting into unions? Did that prevent him from getting into
Of course, there's always been a problem. I think even today there's still somewhat of a problem in some way, although then the best you could hope for, I think, without any education or anything else, even sometimes when you had the education, you were denied the opportunity to work in various classifications. But of course, my father, you know, being just an average person, the best he could get was a job as a laborer, either carrying brick or mortar or working as a helper, etc. And of course, going on from there, I think if you observe your parents doing this kind of work and that's all you see and that's all they do, and if things don't improve substantially, many cases, the youngster falls into the same old stereotyping type of job classifications, and they grow up and do the same thing, and this repeats itself. And I think that's probably one of the historical problems that's affected the black community in terms of being able to upgrade and get into some of the higher levels of jobs where you can earn and, of course, get equal treatment.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned bricklaying. In one of our other interviews, Dr. Parrish indicated that the administration building at U of L, with the arches, the brick arches, mm-hmm. that was done by black bricklayers.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm not sure the date. But over the years, and when the unions came in, blacks were really excluded from doing that kind of work. I didn't know whether your father had run into that.
Not really. He wasn't a bricklayer. He was a laborer. He did more of the servicing to the apprentice, or what you might call craft type individual. But that's very true. In the beginning, way back, I guess maybe he could have been trained if he could have had the opportunity to become a bricklayer, but that's basically what he did. But of course, we understand that historically blacks have had skills, and the ones who were imported in that had the iron trade or knew about masonry work, what have you. I assume that work was done by them to help develop the country in terms of free labor or whatever kind of labor it was. But then as this became a higher paying skill and it got organized, of course, they were exempted from it. And this has always been a problem in that type of thing. I also understand there was other areas where minorities or blacks had input and inroads as far as hotel servicing and, well, you name it, it was there. But that got lost or strayed or stolen as time went on, if it involved economics, of course. But I'm sure he had some difficulty, because basically you were looked at as a laborer, and that's pretty much the classification, and most minorities or blacks were concentrated in those classifications, and that's laborers. And that still is true today. I think if you look in most organizations, you'll find a heavy concentration of blacks at the operatives and laborers categories compared to the officials and managers, technicians and professionals. And I think historically this is one of the problems. I'm not saying that it's all of the problem, but it certainly is one of the problems when people have been denied the opportunities to train and learn and develop in those areas, and of course give their kids that same opportunity in terms of a model for the kid to see their father doing these kinds of jobs, then that tends to have people exempted. So this is some of the problems that we still have, I think, to some degree.
We talked with, along those lines, I'm jumping ahead now, with Mr. Price at Mammoth Life. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about some of the problems that a black-owned insurance company has in getting new business, especially when the majority of their business is black. And he indicated something that maybe you could comment on, that when they would try to finance, say, invest the insurance money in a shopping center, mm-hmm. or a building of some kind, hotel, they did not run in the same social circles with some of the people in the white community who would be doing these kind of projects, which was kind of a handicap. Have you found that to be true?
Yes and no. I think today, you know, you can't just live in the black community. I think you have to expand yourself and be flexible and work with people who can be of assistance to you in whatever field of endeavor you're going into. But there's no question that if you don't know the right people, or the people who deal with high finance, who can give you the kind of interest rates that will help you get started, or where you can get the tax benefits or get the operating capital or the kinds of knowledge that's necessary to be able to be successful. That's always been a problem with the entrepreneur, the black who is interested in developing a future business, is the fact that so often things are overlooked and mislaid, but when the black decides to develop something, the city or somebody comes up with rules and regulations that prohibits the minority or the black person from being successful. And I found some problems like that. I've had to deal with the race issue in some instances in developing my shopping center, of course.
This is on Broadway?
28th and Broadway, right, Lyles Plaza. And the gentleman wanted to talk to me about ingress and egress, and I said, well, my friend, you know, I can take you right now to several centers on Shelbyville Road, as well as Poplar Level Road and other places, where the ingress and egress is 15 times worse than what I'm proposing here. And for you to even consider a disapproval based on the information you're giving me is just ridiculous. And I had to take that attitude.
The entrance to the shopping center?
Yes, this is what I'm talking
for
about.
For automobiles,
or trucks, or what have you. And yeah, I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different ways to get in and out. And I know several places only have 2. And you can take Thornsberry's right there. I hate to use their name, but that's the name of the store in this little strip center on Shelbyville Road. It's only 2 ways in, and you can't hardly back up without bumping another car. So it was difficult for me to deal with that situation, and I had to lay on the line. I think so often you have to do your homework and put people on the spot to explain to them, why are you being so difficult in this situation? Is it because I'm a minority or black, or just what is the reason here? Yes, I can understand progress, and you certainly want to develop things that are better than what you've given people the right to develop in the past. But still, I think my statements and my information was valid, and it proved to be so. But it's just the agonizing time that it takes to convince people that you're trying to do something worthwhile. So these are the kinds of problems I think that, that a number of blacks run into, because historically I think maybe some of the city fathers or people who involved in giving you permits, etc., are not used to blacks coming to them with ideas and trying to develop and do something in the community. As long as it's run down and it's raggedy and underdeveloped and the people who own the housings and so forth keep it that way, fine. And they say, well, that's what they want, that's what they like. But you try to change that, all of a sudden it becomes an economical value, and people tend to say, well, what's going on down there? They prefer to say, well, that's the West End, you know how that is. But as soon as you talk about developing progress, all of a sudden one wants to put restrictions on you. And I think these are some of the things that makes it difficult. It's no different than, I must say this, the program in the paper. You might have seen this program. They're talking about you can purchase a house for a dollar, but yet you have to live in the house, and they showed some figures as what it's going to cost to renovate the damn thing. And I said, well, what in the world is this? Because I could probably do it, and some other contractors could do it, but they don't want to live in the house. But they could probably buy for a dollar 10, 15 houses in one block and revamp them or rehab them or what have you and rent them out or sell them. But when you tie a guy's hands and say you got to live in the house for a period of 3 years or you're going to have to remodel it, and you talk about $40,000, $20,000, $60,000, $80,000, well, I forget what those figures were, but they were high. That's just outlandish. Whereas the program should stretch out and say, okay, fine, we're talking about getting the house for a dollar, we're talking about anyone who's capable of developing can do it, we're talking about working on a program where you can work with the people who supply the wood, the masonry, the plumbing, and so forth, and we give you a break all the way down the line, therefore you can get something done. But that's a slap in the face for someone to say, here's what the city is going to do, and then turn that around and restrict anybody who would be capable of doing it from doing it. Now, that's just the kind of thing that I'm talking about. That kind of program, I don't want to say too much about it, but I felt I had to say it based on the kinds of things we're talking about here now in terms of development, in terms of making sure that the total community as well as neighborhoods develop and be viable and be able to assist one another and have the kind of relationships around our city that we ought to be thinking about, rather than thinking in terms of restrictions and thinking in terms of stereotyping people as to the way it used to be or the way it is, and not trying to investigate and explore and find out why.
You think anything is the situation may be getting better? I know this is a recent example you just gave, but
well,
in the past when you developed your shopping center to today,
on an individual basis, I'd say yes. On an individual basis, it's getting better. Collectively, I'd say no. In terms of the minority or the black group as a group of people, they are affected, I think, with the economical slap in the face more than anybody in this country. And I'm talking in terms of education, I'm talking in terms of housing, I'm talking in terms of pay. I think now the median income of a black is three times less than that of white. And I think the figures now will reflect figures all the way back to 1953, so this is 77. So if it's as bad as now as it was in 53 in terms of the masses, then I don't see any growth. Yes, you can talk about growth when you talk about someone being appointed to the Supreme Court or the political situation where you have a large number of black politicians and all that, and then it allows a shopping center, you can point to that. But when you talk about the total well-being of the black community as part of the total community, I'd have to say that I'm not sure that that much progress has been made.
Mm-hmm. There's a kind of along those lines, I have a quote here from a book that I was reading. It's entitled From Slavery to Freedom. In one passage, said that during the years of the Negro Revolution, and they were talking about the 60s, it was widely assumed that the vigorous thrust for equality had begun to close the economic gap between Negroes and whites. The assumption was entirely erroneous, caused in part by the opening of a few widely publicized opportunities that can best be described as massive tokenism. Economic differences failed to increase, and in 1963, the unemployment rate of Negroes was 114% higher than whites. you would say that that same situation exists today.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. I think you can look at figures, and I think they'll show you in the 50s and the 60s and now the 70s, and you can relate that information, and you can see that even though you and I can sit here and point to individuals who've done well, and as you might say, tokenism or whatever you might want to call it, and they're used as models, etc. But overall, and you look at the total group, in terms of the numbers of blacks in this country, which is, I guess, about 30 million or whatever it is, and the numbers of blacks in the city of Louisville, you're talking about maybe 25%. When you look at it from that point of view, I'd say about 2% or 3% are doing fairly well, and the rest is still fumbling around in the murky clay, I would say. So until the total segment is getting can get some relief in terms of an affected group, only then do I see real progress. And I think those numbers will bear out what I'm saying. And until it's looked at like that in terms of a Marshall Plan for the cities where you have high population among blacks, if we can rebuild Europe, surely we can do something about our cities and give people a hand up, not a hand out, so that they can participate and be recognized and become a part of the mainstream and make a contribution. And I think until all of us recognize that, blacks as well as whites, and in particular whites who control the economical situation or the political scene, until that's recognized and dealt with, I don't think that we'll have a healthy situation until that time.
This is going to be fair question, but you mentioned a Marshall Plan for the cities. If you could develop a Marshall Plan for the cities, what do you think the, say, three or four of the top priority goals should be? Education, jobs?
Well, it's difficult to say, but I think the first thing would have to be jobs, because without income or without profit and people producing things, you can't do much else. Education is fine, but it depends on what kind of education you're talking about. I think if everybody is working, regardless of what kind of job they have, if they're paying taxes and they're working and they have something to occupy their minds and something to do, well, I think that's good. I think education can come from that, because most education costs money, or there's some kinds of programs that don't cost money. But anyhow, I'd have to say that the jobs and a decent place to live would come first on my agenda, because generally I think most people have common sense and mother wit, therefore they know how to survive. But if one doesn't have a job or doesn't have any outlook of getting a job, it's pretty hard for that individual to believe in anything. So I think in any kind of plan, one would have to take a hard look at the problems and try to identify the problems, and once they're identified, then set the plan into motion in terms of what's the high priorities, and try and work on that. Maybe on a block-to-block basis, I think that in this city, if some kind of way private enterprise and the banks could get together and talk about, in terms of taking a block or taking X number of houses per unit, meaning the bank or meaning the industrial group, and deciding on forming some type of cooperative and saying, we are going to do this. And then, of course, if that was some federal matching money or city government matching money, and go along with that and either rent or sell or just redo the whole thing, and then, of course, set up a staff of people to train and educate and deal with beautification and that sort of thing, and education as far as how to live and health and welfare and all that. That's correct. And I think if that sort of thing was put into motion, then they could do a pilot project in one neighborhood and see how that worked out, and get it going and get the people excited and get it working and have neighborhood captains and so forth, and then kind of move from that neighborhood to the next neighborhood and just keep going like that and keep the ball rolling and have meetings and whatever. I think it could be done. I don't know all the ins and outs of it, and I understand that the cost factors are there, but I think if everybody would pitch in, I think you could eliminate some of the cost factors. It's no different than if I wanted to build a house and wasn't able to do it, and then the city said, okay, here's a house, we're going to give you a piece of property, and now you have to do the rest. Well, that's tough, because if I don't have the resources and know-how, I can't do anything. It's like you give me a car and I can't drive. But I think if you go all the way down the line and deal, as I said before, with the people who supply the wood and the bricks and the pipes and the electrical and et cetera, and everybody says, well, we all going to do our part, whatever it takes to get the city develop whatever it takes. We're going to do it together. We're going to help each other and get this thing on first base. I think if that kind of attitude existed and someone would call in all of these kinds of people, say, look, here's our problem. We got these problems in our city totally. And here's the target areas. Here's the first priority and the second priority. Here's what we want to do. We're going to require a lot from everybody. We're going to require the blacks to do such and such. We're going to require the industrial people to do this. We're going to require the financial institution to do this. We're going to require or ask or solicit your help for the supply and service people to do such and such and give everybody a task and then try and go from that point of view in terms of what can be done. Don't start talking about, well, we got to pay taxes. Well, you know, if we do that, well, it's going to do this. You give me a house for a dollar, then you turn right around and tell me you live in it and renovate it, and then give me a time limit, and then tell me and give me figures that's going to cost $40,000 to rehab it. Hey, wait a minute. I'm a poor man. I just can buy it for a buck. Now you're going to tell me I got to spend $40,000. Where am I going to get it from? I don't care if you tell me about 3% money or 1% money. It makes no difference. That's a tough task. So I think it can be done if enough people sit down and make it a priority and look at it in terms of a project.
It could be done. Economies of scale and buy in bulk. That's correct.
And you could do a pilot project by utilizing one block. I can find any block. I thought of it myself. I thought of developing, but I know that I have to go to the bank. I have to go borrow money. I probably not live long enough to see it to be a reality. It would take a lot of time, a lot of effort, and a lot of help. And you know, if the banks can't work with me, or if supply and service people can't work with me, and the people who are going to live there don't work with me, it just can't be done. But I think it could be done if enough people would get behind it. I think, you know, a lot of things you try and do, like the inner city development down there and so forth, there's a lot of problems tied to that, and a lot of reasons why that's not working. You know, I'm not one to know everything, but I think a lot of times people do things just to get ahead or get their name there, and then they move from that to something else, but never complete the project. So I think the key is to try and look at the city as a whole, and look at the community as a whole, and look at neighborhoods, and then decide what can be done. I know that in Butchertown or wherever it is, the people there are aggressive, and they're doing a hell of a job, and they've gotten some direction, and they're not waiting for anybody, they're just going on and doing this thing. But some neighborhoods they're more depressed than that. You have people who don't have the leadership, or maybe they don't have the know-how or the contacts, etc. So it's much tougher for them to get started. But on a small scale, I have been able to observe of homeowners in the West End who are making some effort. I'm not talking about the West End where you have the affluent black. I'm talking about just in the area of 28th Street where I am. I've been able to observe people making all kinds of efforts to restore and rebuild and what have you. And I think many things can happen. I've had companies to give me paint or give me certain things, and I say, okay, fine. I know somebody can use that. And I say, look, we get some help, get some of the guys on the corner or whoever can swing a brush and get some supervision, and I'll give you the paint if you'll do this. So these are the kinds of things I think that can be done on a big scale. I mean, someone would head the committee. You'd have officers. You'd have accounting, the whole bit. And decide on how to get it done. Then I think you generate more activity, and more people would decide to join in, and they could see something happening. I've noticed that happening just at 28th Street. I, of course, developed a center there. It took me 5 years to do it. Across the street, this little rundown place, a restaurant. I'd like to purchase it, but the guy wants too much for it. He won't fix it up. The lady who's renting it from me is a restaurant. She's trying. She's doing the best she can. The guy that cleans up for me cleans up around her place. And a guy opened a small store across from my center, so he's doing something. I noticed the tube turns over there. They purchased National Distillers, and they're going to put some warehousing in there or whatever, so they're developing that. Dr. James up the street, she's put her medical center there. There's the roller rink up the street there. There's a little ice cream place. Church's Chicken has come in. So a lot of things can happen, and if you look in churches, that means that there's 5, 6, 8, 10 jobs for black kids in the community to get those jobs. So what I'm saying is it can happen, and it's happening on a small scale. And I notice a lot of the houses in between the residential, they're trying. But you got some property there that's just sitting there that's owned by people who are supposed to be responsible people, but there's no pressure on them to do anything, so they're not concerned about it. If they would all just give it to me, I'd be happy to try and find other people who wanted to help and participate and put them in, and if I can get other help to remodel or what have you, I know guys who I think would help at a reasonable cost, you see. So this could be done. I don't mean me so much, but I'm just saying that because I see the problem and I'm dealing with it as best I can. But you got to have a financial base before you can do anything. You got to be able to help yourself before you can help someone else. So these are some of the things that I see from a point of view, and that's one reason why I'm back here in Louisville, I think, is because I like the city. I know a lot of people. I went to school here, and I feel like I want to make a mark here, and I want to leave something when I pass on that shows that at least here's one man who tried or who made some effort to bring services to the community and jobs and be a taxpayer and, of course, be productive. And, you know, so often it's very hard to get recognition in your own city where you feel that you have some credibility. People tend to look at you and look at the negative side, or if you have difficulties or problems, they blow it out of proportion. And for what reason, I don't know. Maybe that's just the nature of a human being. I hate to believe that. But these are many of the problems that you face when you're out there dealing and trying to move forward. So that's just, you know, some of the things that I see on the surface, and I think it's going to take a lot of recognition from a lot of different people before we can get the job done.
I wonder, maybe we could backtrack a little bit and start from when you went to, from Central to U of L, to the football program, which you majored in, and did you have your aspirations to go on and try pro football at that time? Or?
No, it was not. I went to the University of Louisville. I really didn't want to go there. I was going to go to a black school because I wasn't that familiar. I never had been into an integrated scene before. I went to Central High School, and it was all black school. And, of course, university, it was a little scary for me.
That was just recently integrated, too, wasn't it?
Yes. Which has a lot to be said about that, too. But anyway, I
wasn't... What year did you begin?
I graduated from high school.
The merger with the municipal college was just in 51.
Well, a little ahead of me. I didn't, you know, wasn't familiar with it. I heard some flack in the paper about that and so forth. And, of course, the reassigning of teachers and that sort of thing. Of course, only one person was able to be hired, I understand, one or two, whatever it was. But anyway, I didn't have any real, I wasn't even thinking about going to college. I was a pretty good athlete in high school in Central, but evidently the university thought I could get in school and they thought I could make it with some help. And of course they said, Lenny, if you come out, we'll recruit three more blacks so you won't feel lonely on campus. And of course, understanding that, you know, you're a fellow who don't have much resources, so therefore we'll give you a place to live on campus and so forth and so on, and no graft, of course, now, because in those times they wasn't giving up anything, not that I wanted that sort of situation, but I think about all you could get was laundry money then. Anyway, they made the offer, but I didn't have any real aspirations of going there, and pro ball was just way, way out of sight. I was thinking maybe when I graduated from high school I would go to the services. But anyway, I looked at it and thought about it, and I thought I would give it a try and talk to my mother and so forth. So I went on to the university, and thank goodness for people out there that had an interest in my welfare, and one being Coach Clark Wood, who he's been with me through thick and thin, and he's still there now if I needed him. We've kind of got to know each other real well, and he was always one to be there if I needed help. And some other people at the university, Mrs. Emberger, who was an English teacher, who stayed by me and helped me and flunked me and said, you should take it over. And that helped. I mean, I realized my shortcomings based on the fact that I didn't have the structure from the beginning. So without that kind of help from people, Coach Dan White and Mr. Keene and many others who took some type of interest, which helped me to develop and think that I could make it. And after getting in the university and being there for a few years, I began to get a feel for it, and I liked it, and I had no problem going to class. I never was late. I always would go to class. I didn't. Wasn't the sharpest person in the world, but I would try. And based on that, I think the people accepted me as an athlete who was attentive and did all I could do, and therefore I was able to get through school with a lot of help, remedial training and classes, and then of course I married my wife, Faith Lyles, Faith Wilson, time. I'm a senior year there, and she, I'm a sophomore year, and she gave me a lot of help. She's pretty sharp, and without her help, I would have had some difficulty. And anybody that I needed help from, I'd go to them and ask. So I was able to graduate on time, and that was a big plus for me. And of course, I was playing pretty good ball, and I was a pretty fast guy in track and so forth. And I started getting these inquiries about playing professional football. And upon that, I began to think maybe it was something else I could do. And they were talking to decent money, and I'd never seen that kind of money before. So I said, well, maybe I'd give it a try. And I decided to try professional football, and fortunately it worked out for me, and it helped me to go on and do what I've been able to do to this point. And that's more or less, I'd say, one of the foundations in my life is athletics. I have to say that, and it kind of hurts me a little bit to look at the situation now in terms of the athletic program in the city, in terms of what's being talked about, cutting the budget. Maybe there's something to that, but I think athletics, the way I feel about it, is certainly necessary for some young men, because that's probably, as bad as it might sound, the only thing that keeps them in school. Mm-hmm. I like to believe that every athlete is concerned about his academic background, and he should be. And every time I talk to kids, I talk about that based on my experience and knowing that the two go together. But so often that can be a foundation for a kid to build the interest as to why he should have the other as well as the athletic background. So that pretty much gets us into the university and, of course, in the pro ball, which, as I said, that wasn't a plan of action. I didn't say that, okay, I'm going to prepare myself for professional football like most kids do today. So most kids today know about the money, the economics of it, and what they can do and all the competition and so forth. So maybe these kids today start in high school thinking they're going to prepare to go into pro ball. Well, I didn't think of it that way. I was happy to be selected at the time.
Did so often we hear about the black athlete who's recruited and then more or less used by a university until his scholarship runs out and he's no longer eligible. You seem to have had quite a different experience at it.
Football when I was at the university wasn't that big time. We were an independent school. I think, of course, the black athlete in many cases is an outstanding athlete, or some of them are. And maybe we would say that they're used more because of their publicity and the fact that they maybe make the most touchdowns.
There shortly, but we'll continue with that.
I think most athletes are used. I think that's, as long as they're not misused. But you're there to play football, and that's what you get the scholarship for, basketball, whatever it is. And I think the coach is going to get as much out of you as he can. It's unfortunate that some schools don't see the advantage of making sure that the athlete gets the academic background as well as the athletic background. And many schools are not really concerned about that. I think all they want you to do is build a championship team for them. And if you don't make it on your own as far as graduating on time or what have you, then goodbye. And it's flush peddlers, basically. But I think when I was there, Coach Wood and Coach Kemp and Coach Dunn, Coach Tribue and Dr. Hellman and all the people out there, they were concerned about me being successful, and they were concerned about the four of us graduating because of the fact that it was a first and was maybe we could say a token thing. But the eyes of the city were on the school to see when and what's going to happen. And fortunately, we were fairly successful in having a pretty good ball club. We went to the Sun Bowl that one year.
Did the other three fellows graduate too?
Yes, three of the four graduated, and that was a good mark, I think, which gave some credibility to the situation of the model of bringing blacks to the university, and of course living on campus, which was all a first, and getting used to and some sinking time and all that. But it wasn't easy, and it was quite difficult. I'd say it worked out. I have to say that I think the program was successful.
How did the faculty accept black students at that time and black athletes?
Well, it wasn't that many students. It wasn't that many athletes. I think they could kind of operate autonomous from us, and they didn't have to see us that often, and I think they were able to deal with it. And fortunately, I have to say that the people there were older people, the students, and maybe they were not the kind of black that they deal with today, who could somewhat be more aggressive and want more and expect more and demand his rights better with your black student affairs and all that. Then that wasn't thought of in that sense. We were there, we were trying to struggle to stay there, and you were trying to make it, so you didn't have the numbers, so consequently you were tolerated or accepted, whichever way you want to look at that. And I think the people that were there were more, older people, but they were, I guess, more mature.
The
students, right. You had older black students. Some of the young kids from Central would go there in high schools, but you only had one school to feed the school at the time, one high school, basically. And you had some people from the services and some that I guess had gone to municipal, and they were trying to get their paper to get out to get a job.
Right.
So they weren't concerned about the social activity, if you see what I mean. Mm-hmm. You were trying to get to school.
Right.
And that was a different situation, I think, than it is now. Now, you know, you go to college, you want the same thing that everybody else wants. You want to have a good time. You want to be in the sororities and fraternities and participate in all the activities and all that. Then, you know, just to get there, because it was an opening door process, more or less. So, but it was difficult times, but you kind of more or less maybe accepted your place, I should say that. I think this was kind of the way it was. Today, kids won't take that. They want the whole piece, and they want just part of it. But I think we're so busy, wrapped up in trying to make it, didn't have time to think in terms of what we should get. It's what we could make out of what we had. And I'd say that a percentage of the instructors were fair and favorable, and I think they were educated enough to understand that if the school administration were going to accept blacks, then they had a responsibility and obligation to at least make every effort to be fair. I don't know what the attitude was like or what the deep emotional feelings were, but the main thing at the time was to at least be treated fairly as possible. And I don't recall too much, too many problems, because I was an athlete, and I did well. And I of course, when I did well, that was a mark for the school. So the school got mentioned in the press, and they knew who I was. And I think based on just the athletic ability alone, they felt that I was Mr. Who's Who. Not in the sense that they were going to have me out for dinner, or that they were going to introduce me to their neighbors, but at least, well, that's our boy, you know, he's done well, and he's okay. If all of them are like him, fine. So, you know, you had to kind of accept that at that point in time. And that's pretty much the way it was, I think.
Were you there when Johnny Nines was?
John, well, my first year was John's last year. He was graduating, and I played 1 year with John, yes.
I didn't know that he might have influenced you going to Baltimore then.
No, not really. Baltimore drafted me, number one draft choice. I knew that John was there, and I guess maybe I wanted to play with John in the back of my mind. But at the time, if you were drafted number one by somebody, you pretty much accepted that, because you knew you were going to get a pretty good, the economical situation in terms of pay would be much better than going to a team where you might want to go, and you were drafted number 27. So it was pretty much laid out, but of course I knew John fairly well in the times, in the days that he was at U of L, and it was good to go to a ball club where at least you knew somebody. And John and I are good friends today, and we communicate quite a bit when we have the opportunity. And John and several of the ball players, I was able to develop good relationships. And matter of fact, on Sundays, we didn't have very much. My mother was normal working person, no professional or anything like that, just a service worker and just a job. But on Sundays, of course, the cafeteria wasn't open at the university, and she'd always fix dinner for me and whoever I'd bring by. So she'd fix a lot of food, and I would take John and Jack Mead and George Kane and Andy Walker and whoever wanted to go. So we'd go by and we would eat. And even today, when I see John, he'll ask about my mother, and he never has forgotten the time that we'd sit there and eat the beef and the greens and the cornbread and whatever we had, you know. So, you know, that was the time in life, I think, that people will always remember. No matter how far you get up the scale, I think you can recall the good times, and I do quite often.
That's good. You have some good memories. How was life in pro football for you?
It was tough. not being the greatest pass catcher in the world, going to a team like the Baltimore Colts, where at that time you had to play flanker as well as running back, and had a hard time adjusting. I had the speed and the size and all the other things, but I couldn't adapt to the system. And I don't feel that I was given full opportunity to adapt. And understanding that to some degree, because they needed to win now. And I don't hold any malice against the coach for releasing me in 58, after the 58 season, during the 59 season, because I was not able to perform to the expectations of the coach and I'm sure some of the players or what have you. But that didn't discourage me that much. It did some. And of course, I was picked up by the San Francisco 49ers in 59 and 60. So I went out there and played two seasons. And thank goodness for people like Jack Christensen, who was able to determine that I had some ability. And he worked with me as a defensive back. I played some offense, but I never was able to do the kinds of things that the pros wanted me to do in, as an offensive back. And there was always some other good backs, too. So it never quite worked out. But Jack was able to look at me and see some capabilities that I couldn't even see, or the head coach, or the scouts even. And Jack started working with me on an individual basis and after practice and any time. And thank goodness for that, because that was the beginning of my professional career, I'd say, in 59 and 60, 61.
Moved from the offense to defense.
Right, to defense, right. And then when I went back to Baltimore, I was a veteran and I lived in California, and lifestyle's a bit different there, and I was able to build some confidence, and I kind of realized who I was and what I could do. And when I got back to Baltimore, I was kind of a veteran. I was seasoned and I was tough, and I couldn't be discouraged, and I had the fight and determination and the mental toughness, and that's when I broke in, when I got back to Baltimore. Baltimore was tough because it was a kind of ball club that wasn't going to carry with six blacks. And anything, if you had seven, well, the seventh guy had to go. And, of course, at that time, the seventh person had room by himself. But as time moved on, and then, of course, Don Shula came in as coach, and he said, well, here's the rooming list, and this is the way it is. And I looked up, and I was rooming with Rick Volk, White, you know, and didn't make any difference. That was it. So, therefore, if I room with you, we walk to breakfast together, because we get up and we got to go to practice at the same time. But if you segregate the players, then everybody assumes that's the way it ought to be. And that's the kind of thing we lived in. We played together, ate together, but we didn't associate, and we didn't have the social life and that sort of thing. I think that's not true today. You see it somewhat different. There may be some things that don't quite always stack up. But I think overall,
did Don Shula change the policies?
Yes, he changed his policies and the system as far as building a ball club. And I think that's some of the reasons why we won the championship in the years that we were there. And of course, we did win the world championship in 58, my first year. But we had the talent, and we had the people to do it. I can remember many tough times, squabbles and problems. And blacks kind of stayed together. You know, the six of us kind of palled around together and talked about the problems. And, you know, we tolerated the situation. Of course, if you were good, and you were all right, you know, you were a good man, let's just go get it done, make the touchdowns for us, et cetera, which is fine, too. But then it took a long time to build the social atmosphere. Not that you need that. Evidently, you can get along without it, and it's happened that way for years. But that only solidifies the bond between people on a team, I think, when you have everything together or you're able to communicate totally. Families, wives, players, et cetera. And I think that's been built up over the years. But it wasn't easy playing professional football. It was tough. You had to play out there at about 65-70% because you were hurt most of the time. Played a lot of exhibition games then, about five, and the season was relatively short. I think we had about 12, 14 games. And the competition was pretty keen. And I had to learn a lot of things in professional football. You know, you don't have any friends. You're out there trying to win a job. I think that it was difficult for the black to some degree, but then depending on his ability to break in or to be productive on the ball club, that had a lot to do with his plight. But at any rate, a lot of that changed. And on an individual basis and a team-by-team basis, things were somewhat different. I could see a big difference between the Baltimore coach in 1958-59 and the San Francisco 49ers when I went out there to play for them in 59, 60, and 61. Totally different, that different atmosphere, the feelings of the ball players, the attitude, association and the social life and so forth. Understandably so, looking at the location of the two teams. I know at one time in Baltimore, I understand the seating arrangements were segregated. I don't know if that's ever been that way in California. Maybe it was, but when I went out there, it was real nice. And
it was integrated with the 49ers in San Francisco and segregated in Baltimore when you first began.
In the beginning, right. The beginning. Right. You felt more a part of in San Francisco. You felt like you were part of the team, and the guys were free swingers, you know, and we got along very well. Baltimore was a little cliquish, a little tight. You had your not to just, now I won't say that because it might not sound right, because everybody that's one race or another might not always be the same or have the same attitude. But you had groups of people on the ball club that had their own little interest, and that was something that was difficult. Whereas out in San Francisco, Bob St. Clair, our captain, he, hell of a guy, he just made everybody happy, you know. He was, we all going, whatever it was, you know, Bob would take care of it. John Brody, hell of a guy. It was a little out of control in Baltimore. The contrast, the difference, you know, guys would go to their club or their place, and of course, Baltimore, you know, it's more of a, I don't like to say southern, but the atmosphere was the way it was. And only in the years when I got back in 62, 63, 64, did we get invited to the Italian place to eat, or did we start working as a unit in terms of if something was going on extracurricular, then everybody went. Or you got the message, or someone told you, or you made sure you got there, or you got recognition, or whatever it was. So it took time, and understanding the difference. So. Oh, yeah, sure, change. Right.
Pro football is a funny thing you mentioned. You have to build as a unit, as a team to win, yet in the very beginning of the season, you're competing for the jobs, and I guess all through, and plus people get traded and are leaving all the time. Did all those things perhaps hurt or maybe contribute to race relations?
Oh, no. That happened. That was always happening. That was just normal procedure.
That was just considered part of the life.
Of course. It's only bad when a group of people are they always the ones to be traded or let go or dealt with if you got hurt and, you know, you didn't get the treatment, or they said, well, you got to get well faster, we got to let you go. That's the only time the system broke down. The same thing applied to everybody. You understood that if you didn't make it, I was competing against you and it was your job against my job, but the tough thing to understand is when I was better than you and the majority preferred you and not me, then they would let me go, and there I am, and you're still there. And that's happened in many cases, not only with blacks, with whites too. But that was more prevalent then. You know, if you had a black that was borderline, or he wasn't on the first team, but he was better than the guy on the second team. But the guy on the second team had been there 3 or 4 years, and everybody liked him as part of the clique. So let the black go, keep old Bill, you know.
That's the way it was then, but yep, it's kind of changed now. Or you
It's more competitive and it's changed a lot. I think the coach is looking for the guy who can win for him.
Yeah,
it doesn't make much difference. And I think in many areas you see blacks dominating athletics. Although if you look at it closely, you find that even though they're dominating athletics in terms of percentage of representation, you find that by classification, by position, that is still certain positions that are laid out for blacks and to compete against each other, and there are positions that's for whites. And that's the only other avenue. And then, of course, when you get into broadcasting and you get into management and ownership, then you also get a skewed situation where there's no participation. So these are the kinds of things, I think, that that you could talk about now. But then it was pretty much difference in terms of not letting the players or maybe more or less segregating one another. But I've seen a big change in athletics over the years. It's much different now.
Were you able now, while you were playing in Baltimore, and I gather you were commuting to Louisville, were you able to keep your ties with Louisville and begin building any type of business interests?
Not business interests, but job-wise, yes. I was playing in Baltimore. I'd always come home during the off-season. I worked in Louisville for several companies here and there. And, of course, when I got the job with Brian Williamson back in 61, 62, 63, whenever it was there, then I realized that football wasn't everything. I could see myself building a future, working in the company, learning the various departments and the activities and the tasks. And then I realized that there was money to be made, and looking at various things that I wasn't even aware of is no different than this article you saw in the paper not too long ago. These people that showed the 100 of the top 10 salaries in the United States or whatever it was, they were making like it was $1 million something a day. I forget all these various executives. You know, you wouldn't think that being an executive or a company official that kind of money existed. You felt, well, being black, you know, football, sports, that's where the money is. But that's not where the money is. I mean, that's just a place where you can maybe get some recognition and publicity and make a few dollars. But I began to realize that, and then I said, well. And then as I worked in the company and learned more information and got more involved in business and management, I realized that I could do more. and I began to explore possibilities of land development, ownership, and this sort of thing. It wasn't easy, and still not easy. It's tough. It's tough for anybody, not necessarily black. I think it's tough for anybody to be a business manager or to be a business owner, property owner. But anyhow, the thing that helped me, I think, is the fact that I realized early, and I started every off season working in real estate or working as a sales rep for somebody. And then when I got with B&W, I liked it, and I decided to just throw the towel in here and work every year. And I'd come back after the season was over and go right to work. So I've been able to build a career at Brown & Williamson, and things are real pleased with that.
Did you have to have any academic training in business, or did you have any?
No, I didn't. I was a major in economics and sociology, and minor in physical education. Most of mine I learned in the street. Well, I learned from reading. I learned from people that were already in business. I learned from trial and error, and I think I'm fairly sharp. I'm knowledgeable. I don't know all the techniques of maybe of anything, but I think I'm able to listen and observe and read. And I think I know how to make a dollar. And the bottom line is cash flow, or tax credit, or whatever you want to call it. Therefore, when I see something and I look at the, I try to look at the bottom line or the outcome, or how can you be productive and whatever it takes to get that done, then that's the things that I kind of zero in on. And I was able to learn from people who had had the experience, or people who had been in business before, who took the time to sit down with me. And I think a big part of management in business is participation and doing the job as a manager. Figures aren't difficult. They're right there. You know, you either make $100,000 and you spend $200,000 to make $100,000, or you spend $50,000 and make $100,000. So, you know, if you're going to spend 43% to make 70%, that's good. You know, as long as your sales exceed your purchases, I think you're doing pretty good. But then you got to also look at your expenses and your labor. And when you get all that away and you look at your net effect and you got some cash left over, then you say, well, I think I'm doing pretty good. And I would have to say that one is. It's that simple, I think. But trying to make that happen is difficult. You know, what do I do? And if you're able to isolate the problems and find out why you lost money, or why did I purchase this piece of equipment versus that one, which one's going to last the longest, what can I expense, what can I expense, those kinds of things. You know, once you get a handle on that and learn how to buy and sell, and then, of course, accommodate people if you have that kind of service business, then I think one can be successful. I think historically blacks have that in their background. It's probably lost to some degree, but I think there's a rich culture there, and you know, anyone can do it. I don't mean blacks, but I think it's just historically blacks have not done it. But I think in the beginning there was something, it had been nourished, and if there was growth, I think it would have continued. And I figure if I can do it and encourage other people to do it, and my children can follow me and so forth and so on, then you get a generation of people that's able to put things together. So I realized early that there was more to making money, or there's more to life, or there's more to everything than just playing football.
How did you get hooked up with Brown & Williamson? Then you,
general manager of the Baltimore Colts. I was talking to him one day, and I was telling him I'm interested in some type of job with industry or whatever. And in many cases, the head office, the Colts or colleges or whatever, they're trying to find jobs for the athletes, and now they have a full program. Understand where they try to locate athletes in various businesses or whatever, or they have a program to try and train or fit people here or there if they are so inclined to do so. At that time, it wasn't much of that, but I talked to this one guy up there who happened to know an officer here, and he wrote him a letter. And I came in for an interview, and nothing happened. The next year, I came back for an interview, and nothing happened. And I continued to come, and I continued to call until they called me in, and we sat down, and I said, well, you know, we can't pay the kind of money you're making playing football. I said, fine, I understand. We don't have any place for you, really, but we'll try you under this guy. And they kind of forced me into an area with a guy, Jay Winarden, as far as college sales, or what you might call a college program, pack-saving type program. And I worked for JO, and things worked real well, and I enjoyed it and didn't mind work. And I think they might have thought I was going to just fall by the wayside because of the pittance that I was making. But I was always, I always did save money, and I was able to survive off of that. And the next year I'd come back, and I'd get home, like, say, January, season was over around Christmas time, December. January 1st, I'd be at the door. So, well, what's my assignment for this year? I think some people used to make bets that, well, we probably won't see him for 3 months. You know, he's out having a good time, going to Florida, spending money, whatever. No. When that season was over, I'd come the next day, when I got home, was in the office, saying, what's my assignment? And I think I impressed enough people that they realized that my intentions were to work at Brown & Williamson. And they had a few problems in certain areas that I was able to go and rectify the situation, show that we had representation. This was during the time of the 60s when, practical to have a black representing a company or working in a company, particularly if blacks were utilizing the product, if you follow what I'm saying. It was a good thing to do, or it was the tokenist type thing to do, or what have you. So I worked out of that and through that up to a position of responsibility, a position where the company, I'm sure, felt they could trust me, and they knew that I had credibility, and that they could send me out with money or whatever, or say, give me an assignment and I could come through, and I could get the job done. It kind of grew piece by piece, and each year they would challenge me with a new assignment or the same assignment with more responsibility. And then, of course, they didn't have any blacks as supervisors in the factory. And, of course, I was the first one to go into there and try that. And it worked out quite well that year, and I did that for about 3 years in a row when I came home. Then, of course, I was asked, well, would you recommend some other people, which I was pleased to do. Another year that I was going back to play ball, of course, what helped me was being an athlete to kind of break the ice of getting a black supervisor over whites or with whites or whatever you want to call it, which was kind of a first. But anyway, when I left that 1 year, all the people that worked for me on my floor gave me, they collected up some money and gave me a nice card. And I think a lot of people were surprised. They didn't think this sort of thing could happen. And I thought I had a real good rapport, and I got along well with the people, and I think I was a pretty good supervisor. And it grew on from there. But that broke the ice more or less, and of course the next black, and then the factors began to build up in terms of supervision. And now I'm right back into the same kinds of work, but at a higher level, in terms of equal opportunity. I kind of was at the bottom building and helping to get it started. And I guess it's ironic, but it worked around where, being a federal contractor, we have to have goals and timetables and affirmative action program. So for some reason or another, I'm back into the same thing, but more at a higher position at an enforcement level. So I understand the total process, if you follow what I'm saying. So it's been good for me. And that's pretty much the way the thing worked out. And I think I influenced a lot of people throughout the Total Corporation by being a person that could understand and work and deal with the problems and the issues and get the job done without a large amount of misunderstanding and problems, you see.
I realize that there's nothing's perfect in this world, but how do you assess Brown and Williamson's integration process in there?
Better than most, I'd say. I'd say that the B&W is a good posture. They're a good corporate citizen community. They're very active in many areas. I don't know that anyone ever reaches their total objective, and that is to see parity, meaning that everybody gets full opportunity. But I think my boss, Frank Kiernan, who I think is very open-minded and flexible in the area of equal opportunity, and I think the policy here is not just words on paper. I think if we implement it, I'm able to exercise a certain amount of authority. I think I ought to have a little bit more, but working for a vice president, maybe I don't need any more. The fact that he has the total responsibility and I work for him to implement the program. And he, of course, reports one level, therefore maybe I have more clout than I think I do. Sometimes you like to see things happen, you like to tell a guy, do it. And, you know, of course, if you're a department head, I can't just walk into your department and tell you to change everything because you report to some other vice president, you see. So you have to understand that, and I have been able to. And I found that you can work with people, you can make people aware of situations and make them understand the benefits. And through that kind of activity, I think the company has been able to make progress. And I think we have the understanding of what we have to do and what our goals are. And I think we've exceeded our goals in many instances, and I think we will continue. But I'd say that B&W overall is probably better and as good, but more or less better than most companies in the United States in terms of their employment situation and the recruiting and the attitude as far as what the company wants to do. I won't deal with individuals, but as a unit, I have to say that we're doing damn well.
And I talked with Lewis Coleman of the Urban League, and he's involved in going around trying to get companies to employ blacks.
Yes.
And he's finding a difficult segregation is becoming more subtle.
Yes.
In other words, he would try to go to a company, and they'll say, yeah, we'll hire some. Do you have any black engineers?
Sure.
That type of thing. Do you find this in the community?
Sure.
Not necessarily Brown and Williamson.
No, that's there. I mean, people are going to do that. One is going to procrastinate. They're not going to do anything. The old question, well, I would hire them, but I can't find them. But, you know, when you're talking in terms of affirmative action, you're talking about doing something about the problem. You're making it possible. Program to bring people along. You go to a school and you offer the services of the company to help develop. You make. You use your resources to make things happen. You don't just sit back and wait. Of course, it's subtle. It's like, I'm sorry, we don't have any more tickets. We're sold out. Well, I can't get in if it's sold out. But if I stand around long enough and watch them sell one to a white person, then I come back to raise hell. But my point here is that there used to be, no, you can't come in. But one can easily say, we're sold out. It's so nice of you, but we're full. Or, I'm sorry, we don't take reservations, or whatever. So that's the thing you deal with today. But that's, in many cases, it's individuals. And it's because the posture of the organization, the top people are not committed enough to make sure that the people who are actually implementing the process at the bottom are getting the job done. So, you know, if I'm in charge of hiring, I can do what I want. But if I have to answer to my boss who says, look, I want you to report to me and I want to know just what our posture is and where are we going as far as hiring and recruiting and so forth and so on, and I want to report. And you know you got to report, so you're going to have to get something done. So the whole thing stems, I think, from how you set it up and what kinds of a base that you have. And I know Lewis very well, and I work with him a lot, and he's had some difficulties. But all companies are not that way. I think some are trying vigorously to do the job. There's others who are just spinning their wheels. Many companies don't know how. Or they have people working for them who give them bad information. And that's unfortunate. I had a guy call me yesterday from Anaconda that wants to come down and look at some things that we're doing here to talk about affirmative action and what he can do to do something about terminations, losing minority females in the workforce. So, you know, that's good that he wants to talk about it. It could be that he wouldn't even concern himself. But there's a great deal of pressure on companies today, too, as you well are aware of. But they don't always get it done because now the law protects everybody. And you're getting a lot of backlash in terms of the majority group saying, if you're going to do something for a minority, then that's taken away from me. Not recognizing the fact that the minority is only trying to catch up and catch up just to his own representation, not to exceed 50%, but just to get a piece of the pie in terms of maybe 12%, you see, or 20%, whichever percentage you want to use. And one can't even deal with that. They don't want you to have that even. You know, you had your opportunity, your chance, whatever. But, you know, you deal with those kinds of things. But, yes, it's in the community and it's in every company. But I think the commitment by the people who make the rules and regulations and have the responsibility of authority can circumvent that and make sure that the job gets done.
Now, this is side three of the tape with Mr. Lyles, and I believe we ran out of that other side, but we'll just continue from where we were.
Talking about being a leader in the community, I think people like Wolf Reporter, I think people like Joe Hammond, I think people like Dr. Parrish, all these people are leaders. All these people are people who are recognized and they're known. But to say that, well, Leonard Lyles is doing it, therefore you should, because he's a leader in the community. Well, you may get a negative response from somebody who says, well, he don't lead me. What do you mean? I don't associate with Leonard Lyles. Some people do. But I think it depends on what are we talking about when we say who are the leaders of the community. I think that has to be defined in terms of what kind of leadership are we talking about.
Just as a comment, it's interesting because you said almost the same thing that Woodford Porter said. There's not one leader. It's like saying who's the leader for the white community.
Sure, right.
I think diverse.
Yeah. If I'm elected as a precinct captain, or if I'm elected as if I run for an office, or whatever it is, or alderman or what have you, and people elect me, well then I guess I'm some kind of leader, because I've been put in a position by the people. Consequently, the people who voted for me recognize me as their leader or as their spokesperson. Therefore, I would feel that maybe I think I'm a model. I'm an individual trying to do a job. Maybe what I say or what I do or my actions would influence people, but I have not been chosen to lead any particular group in that sense. And I think that's the way I look at it. And unfortunately, you will be tagged with that stigma of Leonard Lyles, one of the leaders in the black community. Well, they never define what they mean when they say that. And sometimes that can turn off other people who say, he's not my leader. I haven't elected him to do anything for me. Therefore, for you to write an article and deal with the situation and deal with what I'm saying and accept that as law, it's totally wrong. Because what I might feel or what I'm talking about could be totally different and diverse from what people who live in a certain area might feel.
Everybody has to understand.
You know, you're right, and I think this is a difficult situation. I think a lot of whites tend to do that. They tend to put that tag on you as well, he's one of the guys that leads, you know. And I think if they say he's one of the models, or he's one of the people that is trying to make progress, or whatever. But it's just, we have to define leadership before
right.
we go any further.
Right, that's a good point. Kind of a concluding question. I know you have other things to do today, and I'm. For the future, what do you consider some of the most important goals for blacks in Louisville?
Well, I don't know. It's, that's a pretty tough question. I think several, which are old basic things, and that is to be a part and to grow based on the representation in the workforce, based on the representation in the population, based on their ability to perform, based on given the opportunity to excel and utilize their potential to the fullest in the areas of politics, education, housing, and economical benefits. That it should be the goal of every black person in the world, to be a part of where he is making his home, to participate in, to consume his fair share, to give leadership and direction to his piece of ground or his area, to be recognized and be respected as a citizen of that unit. I think this is all that one can expect out of life. Unfortunately, people have been dealt with to the degree that their thinking could be distorted to the point where one can't set the things I just mentioned as goals. They're looking at, well, someone did this to me, therefore I'm in this situation, so who's going to help me out of it? So we have to deal with that for a while before one can really feel the truism of I'm accepted as part of. Then I can probably give fully and not be so selfish if in fact I can ever think that I'm an individual and I'm able to participate and given a fair share to compete the best of my ability. So I think these are the kinds of things that is the future for blacks in terms of their outlook and how they can make progress. And of course, on top of that is for people who are in control to recognize the things I just mentioned and to recognize that without their understanding and cooperation, and not trying to suppress or be devious in their judgments and activities that maybe affect other people, being understanding to the point where they can help nourish the things I'm talking about and help that to grow. It's like a plant. You see, if I look up and there's a weed or there's a flower all of a sudden, and I fertilize it and I put water on it and I help it to grow, then it's going to grow strong and straight, hopefully, without anything happening to it. If the people who are in control or who have the power to take care of would do that, then you'd wind up with something pretty healthy. But if you do all that you can do, you go by and pull a leaf off every now and then, or you get angry and you put a jar over top of the plant, no sunlight today, but you take it off and get some tomorrow, or give it very little water, then you're not going to have very much. So I think people who have the resources or who can cause that to happen, as Apple might say, get things done through people, I think if they would wake up and recognize that no one's competing with me, but what I can do to make this a better community is to help everybody to grow and to make a contribution. And if I look at the people that way and give them that help, then it's easy to deny. If you've done all that you can do and you've tried to create progress and make progress, then if I say, well, you're not doing your job, you're not carrying your weight, therefore you will be cut out. You will be fired, terminated, or we can't use your abilities anymore because it's not in line with what the objectives are for the total community. Then you won't get any squawk, I don't think, from any particular group saying we're being dealt with. Particularly if you have figures to show that this group is participating as greatly as anyone else based on their representation or based on something that's recognized by the masses of people. So I think that's what the future is all about, and we got to recognize that from both sides. And if that happens, I think we can make progress. Well, we're going to do one or two things. We're going to, I think, succeed together, or we're going to fail together. And I think that's the thing that worries me most.
I'd like to see if you had any general comments you'd like to make regarding just kind of an open forum here. Anything that we might have covered previously, any general comments about the economic aspects?
Nothing general. I just think that possibility of all the total community being successful is based on a lot of things that I've already talked about. I think I recognize that the economics, the city is, I think it's growing to some degree, but I think that everybody's not participating fully. And the job situation is just pretty bad. And we have a lot of problems as far as the court system. I tend to get a feeling that the crime does pay. I don't like to have that feeling. I'm not talking about suppressing any one group, blacks or whites or what have you, but I'm talking about justice, and I'm talking about due process, and I'm talking about if one dances, he must pay the fiddler. Consequently, it doesn't seem to be much happening between the judge and the lawyer, and it bothers me quite a bit. Anytime one commits an act and he gets his opportunity before the bench and he gets chance after chance to keep the victim from getting to court who has to work every day to testify through the efforts of one who has the authority to be before the judge to represent the person who has been charged with a crime or what have you, they can make it awful tough for the victim. Consequently, the victim can't show, though, so the case is thrown out. So these are the kind of simple things that bothers me when thieves and hooligans can do pretty much what they want and be free the next day. I have trouble with that. I'm not sure that I could address the problem. If I did, I'd probably want to put people, go back to the public square deal. You know, you put the rings up, you put them on display in public. Or you send everybody that's not doing right to some island, someplace, to rid the community of the cancer. I'm not that hard, but more than economics, the problems that people do to one another worry me more than anything. You never know when you're going to go in your house and you're going to get ripped off. you never know when you open your door in the business when someone's going to walk right in. And it's just like an open. People don't seem to care, no respect, no anything anymore. And that, of course, is associated with a lot of things. But that worries me, I think, more than anything. And that's the only observation that I can make that gives me a problem. It's like a situation I'm aware of. A person was raising hell and harassing an old little lady. The little lady called the police, and the person that was doing the harassing, the assailant's mother, had the woman locked up who was the victim. And she's in the bond, and she had to go to jail. And she's afraid to say anything to the kid at all because she was put in jail. And it just works that way to me. It's just not right. I don't understand that. It's very difficult. Hard to, you know, you read things all the time about a guy tries to protect his property by setting up a device to trap the thief, and the thief happens to get hurt his leg and lose his leg, and the thief's people, a lawyer, sues the man for all of his property, so he loses. When he was the victim being handled by a thief, then the thief winds up being the one who wins out, even though crime, again, as I say, seems to be paying. Or, I don't know, it's just a tough situation. I think that's the biggest thing that I have trouble with and trying to deal with. As a businessman, you don't know about this until you get into business. Then you get the feeling of what's happening to people in other business. And this hurts economically. This hurts a lot of things. Jobs, man can't hire many people because of these problems. He's spending all his money trying to keep his place together. Consequently, he can't employ. Or you have to lay people off because you're losing money. Or whatever it is, you have to move. You can't stay in a location because the hooligans won't let you stay there. So if you move five businesses, then you've lost maybe 10, 15 employees. These are the kind of things that bother me a little bit. But I guess that's about all I can say.
Yeah, it's something for the future to try to resolve.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you for taking the time out with us today, and that'll conclude our interview, unless you have anything else you'd like to add.
No, it's just that if it's possible, I'd like to have a copy of the tape myself. I'll put you on the spot by saying that here. You probably erase that, but if it's possible, I'd like to hear what I've said. See how it worked out.
I'll talk to Dr. Ryan and see what we can work out.
I'm probably the only one that's requested a copy, I imagine.
So far, yeah. No problem. Well, thank you very much, and I'll shut her off here.
Okay. Thank you. Real fun.